Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. This is your host, Dan Zupansky, for the program True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. A 12-year-old boy cowers in his closet while a lunatic killer slaughters his family. A nursing student unwittingly opens her home to the serial killer on her front porch. An 11-year-old girl drifts alone at sea on a flimsy cork raft for almost 4 days after a mass murderer kills her vacationing family aboard a chartered yacht. A brave firefighter suddenly finds himself in the crosshairs of a racist sniper almost 9 stories above the ground. And astonishingly, they all survived. From Howard Unruh's 1949 shooting rampage through a quiet New Jersey neighborhood to Louisiana serial killer Derek Todd Lee's reign of terror in 2002, the corpses piled up and few lived to tell their tale of horror. Award-winning journalist Ron Francell explores the wounded hearts and minds of the ordinary people these monsters couldn't kill. His mesmerizing accounts crackle with gritty details that put the reader in the midst of the carnage and offer a front-row seat on the complex, painful process of surviving the rest of their haunted lives. Delivered from Evil takes the reader on a pulse-pounding dash through the murky intersection of pure evil and the potency of the human spirit, a journey into the darkest corners of the American crimescape. Delivered from Evil with my special guest, journalist and author Ron Francell. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Ron Francell.
Dan, thank you for having me. I'm just delighted to be here.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sure we'll have a great interview. Now, you've written quite a few true crime books, Maybe let us know what was your decision to sort of, to approach this true crime book from a completely different perspective, and tell us what that perspective was and why you decided to write a book from this unique perspective.
Well, Delivered from Evil is a collection of 10 profiles at its heart. And in each of these, we have vivid portraits of these killers and the survivors as their paths converge and then, of course, explode into a billion pieces. And then we follow those survivors as they're left to pick up those pieces and try to put their lives back on track to something that looks a little bit like normal. I have a great affection for the survivor experience. It was at the heart of my first true crime book, The Darkest Night, which was a very intimate story because it happened to two childhood friends of mine. And I wanted to capture some of that intimacy in Delivered from Evil. So in each of these 10 stories, they're told in the narrative journalism style where we're offering some dramatic interpretation of what happened, largely through the eyes of these survivors. And, you know, I think that it makes it a much more personal story, and for any readers who have read it, and those I think who will read it in the future, they'll get that. They'll see a crime from a perspective that could be theirs.
Right. Now, another aspect that you have included in this book as well is that you purposely told of stories that are not so well known, yet there was a certain magnitude to their crime that certainly warranted an examination from your book, not only because of the victim's perspective and point of view. Tell us a little or a few of the 10 profiles and historically where and when they occurred.
Well, as you mentioned, some of the, the heart of the matter in your introduction, it was about the survivors and not necessarily the killers. You know, I found that as I approached this story and the more of these survivors that I talked to, and I was aware that I was zeroing in on a handful of cases that most people probably hadn't heard of,
right.
I became aware that, you know, the size of the headline didn't matter much to these people. They were in the line of fire. They were wounded. They could have died. They lost loved ones. And they live with the aftermath of this almost as certainly as Representative Gabby Giffords will live forever with her wounds from the Tucson shooting a couple of months ago.
Right.
So in my mind, the story became the survivor's story and not necessarily the notoriety of the killer. So we have in this book, we have these 10 incidents. The first one and the earliest one and the first one in the book is Howard Unruh, a 1949 shooting spree in his quiet little neighborhood in Camden, New Jersey. Unruh was a troubled World War II veteran, and ultimately some paranoid tendencies got the best of him, and he, walked through his neighborhood with a pistol, killing his own neighbors and a few people he didn't even know. He was very calm, very methodical, and very efficient. Among the people he killed was a father, mother, and grandmother of 12-year-old Charles Cohen, who hid in a closet and escaped being killed as his whole family was. But Unruh, killed, 13 that day. And he became, erroneously, he got the label of the father of mass murder in America, and he wasn't the first mass murderer in America. He wasn't even the most prolific mass murderer to 1949 in America, but something he did captured the imagination of the media and of the people, and he did set in motion what has been, a long history of mass shootings here. So he's one of the more recognizable names in there. The Luby's Cafeteria killing in 1991 in Killeen, Texas, where George Henard crashes his truck through the front windows of this cafeteria and then begins methodically killing the diners inside, and kills ultimately 23 and wounds many more. We have a little known case from 1973 of a Navy veteran, a black man named Mark Essex, who becomes radicalized in the Black Panthers and decides that he needs to lash out against white oppression, and he sets fires all over a New Orleans hotel and begins killing white people. In fact, very deliberately skips over many black people that he comes across during this day-long siege. The survivor that I talk about in Delivered from Evil is a firefighter who's responding to these fires hoping to save people, and he literally comes face to face with this killer, this sniper, and a high-powered rifle, and almost 9 stories in the air as he's climbing the ladder. So a harrowing moment, as you can imagine.
Sure.
the McDonald's massacre in 1984 in San Ysidro, California, a very famous mass murder. And I profile in this book, he was a 12-year-old boy, Keith Martens, 12-year-old boy who hid under a table and was shielded from being killed by the father of his best friend. In the end, his best friend and his best friend's mother are killed in that massacre, but Keith survives. And if that weren't harrowing enough, the story of his next 8 or 9 years dealing with this post-traumatic stress will curl your hair. I mean, it is in many ways more horrifying than what he went through laying there under that table in the McDonald's. So they're all in that vein, and again, all put a lot of their energy into the perspective of the survivor.
Now, you must have had some common results and common characteristics that you saw for the most part between all of these victims. After all your research through all of these harrowing stories, what would be the thing that you would say is most common between all of the survivors? You talked a little bit about forgiveness, but tell us what, you know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, tell us what was the commonality that you found between most of these or all of these victims.
Well, they're good and bad. The bad things are that they all went through years, not months, not weeks, not days, but years of nightmares and sleeplessness and paranoia. They developed trust issues, as you might imagine. They had very, very complex feelings about what had happened to them and why. They all avoided at some point in that time. And I hasten to add that some of the people profiled in the book are still on that journey. They haven't completely returned to anything that looks like normal yet.
Certainly.
But they're getting there. But they'll avoid certain people and places and situations that remind them of the tragedy. They've stuffed their emotional responses down a little bit and kind of purposely numbed them. Among these people, I spent as much as 10 days to 2 weeks with each of these survivors. I went to them and spent intensive time and interviews with them. And I found that almost in every case, the first day or so was spent just listening to a story that they'd told 1,000 times. And after that, they increasingly for the next couple of weeks had to answer questions that sometimes they hadn't even thought about before. And they had to summon up emotions that they had pushed down. In many cases, of course, you can imagine we're doing interviews, and I would often say, hey, let's go get some lunch or let's go get some dinner or something. In the cases of, for instance, Keith Martens from the McDonald's or Susanna Gracia Hupp from the Luby's cafeteria, they were visibly nervous about going to a restaurant.
Sure.
And even though they would always go, I would always notice them watching the door, positioning themselves in what they believed was a safe location, and in both of those cases, we are, 20 or more years past the event, but that's how haunted these people are. Many of them turned to alcohol and drugs to kind of dull their pain and this sense of helplessness that they have. Most of them developed survivor guilt. They didn't understand and couldn't compute why they survived when other people didn't. Mm-hmm. Most of them need to talk about their experiences, or did need to talk about their experiences, but people around them sometimes frustrated that, or in some of the successful cases, made it possible. So I came to the conclusion that a survivor of this kind of event really needs somebody to listen to them. And I hope that some of the survivors of the Tucson tragedy have those people. The fact is that some of these people will, some of the survivors that go through this, they just never survive.
Sure.
Or they just never recover, really. They kind of just stop and just wait to die. In effect, they have already died. Now they just need to stop walking around. And that's the sad part of this. Many of the people that I considered for this book had sort of stalled out in that and were not recovering. So I think that that's a sad part of this. But the good stuff, the lucky ones, I think they make a certain peace with their monsters. And that's why I talk about forgiveness. I'm not really talking about it in religious terms or faithful
sure.
terms. I'm talking about it, and most of these survivors wouldn't talk about it as a religious element. They would talk about it as a kind of realization that they couldn't move forward until their monsters no longer played a role in their life, or at least didn't play a starring role. They came to know that, you know, they couldn't possibly hope to regain any of their equilibrium, you know, unless they sort of revoked permission for Charles Whitman and James Huberty and Derek Todd Lee to influence their choices anymore. Now, these people haven't forgotten what happened, you know.
Sure.
And except in one case among these 10, they haven't absolved their killers or their would-be killers. They haven't said, it's okay, I understand. They don't feel that way. But I think each of them... each of them has limited their monsters' roles in their life, and that's, you know, I think a step in the right direction for them. And
nope.
And each of them understands that they got a gift on that day. They were given life when people all around them were dying, and in that sense. When I finished this book, I had this sense that if these 10 people can recover, kind of get back to normal, then the rest of us have hope.
Right. Now, I wanted to talk about, because you've been talking about how the survivor recovers, and you talk about some of the bad elements, obviously the obvious bad elements, but a lot of these characters in this book, and including what we'll start with is Charles Cohen, is that these people were married and had children. So at least in my mind, that seems to be a good sign of recovery if you can move on enough to find a mate that can deal with you despite these nightmares and this certainly post-traumatic stress disorder from all of these people. But the thing is, what you had said was that most of these people somehow put this away, at least tried to not have it affect them. They didn't to absolve themselves of this, but... Charles Cohen wanted to see this person leave this planet, or
oh yeah.
So he was a little bit different, but I thought that this, especially to start the book, all the stories are fascinating, but especially I thought was the Charles Cohen story, because like you say, at 12 years old, and I think that if you could talk a little bit about just the day in question too, that he had thought that maybe his mother had just died. His grandmother, I believe, Rose, had put him in the closet to hide. But his horror started progressively. He not only did he hear this whole thing go down and then found his mother dead, that he also didn't realize till right away that his whole family was gone.
Right.
Then from there, Maybe talk a little bit more about Charles Cohen, because it was unique in his recovery. Not only did he have all these horrible things at a young age embedded in his mind, but the way he recovered and the fascinating story of how Howard Unruh becomes sort of more continual pain for Charles Cohen with what turn of events happened because of Howard Unruh and his case and what they do legally with his court case.
Right, right. Well, you know, Charles is a 12-year-old boy. It's the day before school starts, it's a day or two before school starts, and his grandmother has promised him a trip into Philadelphia to buy some school clothes and that sort of thing. And so he's kind of anxiously waiting for this, and he's sitting at the window, the second-story window of his father's drugstore in this little neighborhood of Camden, and he sees Unruh, their next-door neighbor, walking down the street firing a gun. And he watches as Unruh actually walks up to somebody and shoots him. And he sounds the alarm, you know. He yells, you know, he's shooting people. His mother and father are downstairs in the drugstore. She runs upstairs. Charles is hidden in the closet quickly. Unruh comes through the drugstore, kills the father who's trying to get away, kills the mother, the grandmother, and then leaves without finding Charles. And he actually had an axe to grind with Charles, because Charles was a musician and played his trumpet at night. And it right. bothered Unruh to no end, and he intended to kill Charles. But he moved on this little walk of death, and Charles was left alive. So Charles now is an orphan. Unruh is arrested, and it's very rare for a mass murderer to actually survive these events. Right. But here he is. He's in police custody. He admits what he's done. He describes it in great detail, and he's immediately determined by the prosecutor to be insane. And so he's essentially taken right from the police station to the state hospital in New Jersey, where he spends the next 60 years of his life, never standing trial, never going to court on any of these charges. So here's this little boy. This little orphan. He bounces around with some family for a while, never talking about this, and probably never being allowed to talk about this. And he pushes it deep down inside. Men of the 40s, you know, of that time, they were expected to live with their disappointments, live with their pain, and not complain. And Charles grew up in that mold. He pushed it all down. He never talked about it. He grows up to find the woman he's going to marry, but he doesn't even tell her until their wedding night what has happened to him. And then he never really mentions it again. He has three daughters. They grow up to be adults. And in the early 1980s, Unruh, still in the insane asylum, wants a little extra freedom. This request necessitates a court hearing. Charles is faced with this decision. Does he keep his secret, or does he step up and speak on behalf of the dead, on behalf of his wiped out family, against a little more freedom for this insane killer?
Right.
He decides he's going to speak up, and he literally comes out and becomes the vocal representative for all the people who were injured or killed that day, and maybe by that time a lot of people who had gone through similar circumstances. So Along the way, a fascinating little tidbit that I learned was that along the way, he left his parents' drugstore and never went back. He took some of his possessions in a suitcase. He later turned that suitcase into a kind of time capsule. He would put clippings and pictures and all kinds of artifacts and mementos of this event and stick them in that suitcase and keep it hidden. He successfully hid it all those years. By the time we got to know each other, he had told me that his dream was that someday Unruh would die and that he would take that suitcase out and bury it.
Wow.
And in a sense, he would be burying the memory and the haunt that had collected over all these years. As it happened, he died about 6 weeks before Unruh died in 2009, and he didn't get a chance to do that. But after his death, I was privileged to be able to look through that suitcase and essentially feel his memories and feel his haunt through the things that he had put there. He hated Unruh. He absolutely hated him. And so when I say forgiveness, it's not in the traditional sense. All Charles understood was that he couldn't let Unruh ruin the rest of his life, the life that came after 12 years old. And that was his forgiveness. And ultimately, he understood his role was to speak up for the dead. And he did that eloquently.
And he found quite a bit of catharsis, you had said, in that standing up for other people's rights and coming out of the closet. So that was to his benefit in the healing process, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And I think just as all of these people are somewhere on a road back to normal, there's a piece of each one of them, too, that will never be normal again. And in Charles' case, I think this grinding hatred that he had for this killer. As he said, one of the things Unruh wanted while he was in the asylum was to live closer to his aged mother so that he could visit with her. She would visit him quite often while she was alive. But one of the things Charles said in opposing this new freedom within the asylum was that, he wants to see his mother, but when I want to see my mother, I have to go to a cemetery.
Yeah.
And very poignant, he gave a very poignant voice, I think, to a lot of us.
Sure. Yeah, the thing is, we won't dwell on this too much, but what was the motive for this rampage?
Well, as often happens when these things happen, and we saw it in Tucson, there's this urge to say, well, why did he do it? And in the absence of solid answers, we make stuff up.
Sure.
I mean, we did it in Tucson with the people talking about, oh, it was the political rhetoric. Well, now we know that had nothing to do with it. But
that's right.
But I wager that 20 or 30 years from now, when we talk about Jared Lochner and Tucson, political rhetoric will be mentioned, such as it was with Unruh. Unruh was, had been in World War II. He had been a fairly good soldier, a very meticulous soldier. He would keep a diary of the Germans he killed.
That's very strange.
Yeah, he was a very strange guy. Well, but he had seen combat, obviously.
Sure.
When this happens, the immediate reaction is, oh, he's a shell-shocked veteran.
Sure.
Today, PTSD. But what we now know is that he was severely troubled before the war. He was also homosexual. He had developed he wasn't paranoid schizophrenic, but he had developed a paranoia, and a lot of it related to his homosexuality, which of course was viewed, you know, as badly as it's viewed today. It seems, you know, multiply that by 100 in the 1940s,
sure.
And I think that ultimately you can see in his behavior and his psychology that his difficulties go back to childhood or had very little to do, if anything, with his war experience. As it happened, he had kept a list of people that he wanted to kill, and this had, he'd been doing this for about 2 years by the time the shooting happened. He had gone to a gay cinema in Philadelphia the night before, came back very late, and a new little gate that he had built in his yard, mostly so he didn't have to cut through the Cohen's backyard, this little gate had been knocked off its hinges. And he believed it was done on purpose. And he went to bed and decided that tomorrow morning he would go and kill all the people on his list. And he did. He waited till 9:30 because he knew that the shops would then be open, and many of the people he wanted to kill were shopkeepers. He then begins this methodical trek through his neighborhood, killing not only people who are on his list, but then anybody who happens to be around, including a little six-year-old boy who's getting a haircut from the barber. So what set him off? Well, it seems like it was that little gate thing, but we can see that there were these 2 years of a building paranoia, that people were talking about him and insulting him behind his back and so on. Nothing to do with war. So.
Right. Yeah, it's a very interesting case, too, because given the atmosphere these days, not too many insanity pleas are accepted in courts. And given his cool demeanor and the pre-planning, I think in a lot of states he would not have been sent to the mental institution. That's just my opinion, anyway.
Well, and he didn't have a plea. I mean, he literally was just judged by the prosecutor to be, you know, crazy and,
right.
And needed to go to the insane asylum. No court. The indictment against him stood for more than 20 years. And
yeah.
Until it was just finally dropped, there's no question that in today's atmosphere, and possibly even in the atmosphere of his time, that he would have been judged to be guilty and probably would have faced the death sentence. Even though I think people would have said, yeah, he's nutty. But he knew he was doing wrong. He talks about that.
Sure.
So he qualified for, you know, for a guilty verdict, even though I think we would all agree that he had mental difficulties.
Sure. Now, there's another fascinating case in Chapter 2, which is incredible, another story I knew nothing about, the Brent Doonan and the Atlanta Day trader spree. At Alltech, and Marco O. Barton. This is an incredible story. Tell us a little bit about this, the chemist, the killer. Tell us a little bit about Mark Barton and this incredible story.
Well, Mark Barton, and we have another case here, like Unruh, like Lochner, where the first blush of why he went on this killing spree turns out to be wrong. But Mark Barton was, a kind of happy-go-lucky guy, got along with everybody, but he had a dark side that he kept hidden from the people around him. He had a wife who, with her mother, had ultimately been murdered by an unknown assailant at some years in his past. But he in the 90s got into something that was big back then called day trading. Basically, it was you get on the computer and you do these stock trades, and it might be seconds. And you might only hold a stock for anywhere from minutes to hours, and then sell it, hopefully, at something higher than what you paid for it. So that you would end every day, the goal being that you would end every day with more money than you started with.
Sure.
And a lot of little sort of boutique storefronts opened up all over the country to enable this. All they needed was, you know, fairly fast, very fast internet connection, some computers, and give them some training. The guy would pay a fee and to use the computers and maybe a percentage of his profits. So it was a lucrative kind of thing. And Barton, by this time, is remarried. He's got a couple of kids, and this is his only income, is this day trading. And he's kind of bombastic about it. You know, they called him the Rocket. Because he would do these things, and he was still a friendly guy. Everybody liked him. In time, things start going south, and he starts getting more and more behind, and borrowing more money from these firms to do his day trading. Until by this time in 1997, of the time of the shooting in 1997, he's in deep. And the people around him who have kind of been enabling this at these firms are kind of beginning to call in their markers. Well, one day he just decides, you know, he's going to end it all. He kills his two children in their beds. He kills his wife and leaves a suicide note, basically, that says he did all this, but he didn't kill his first wife, you know, which was an odd thing for a suicide note. But then he goes down to one of the day trading firms in Atlanta and goes in and shoots up the place, then walks across the street to another one, which is co-owned by the survivor that I write about in Delivered from Evil, Brent Doonan. And he shoots Brent, he shoots several other people, and then escapes, all before cops kind of click to what's happening. So he gets quite a jump on the police, you can imagine.
Sure.
Ultimately, 12 people are killed, 13 are wounded, and he's surrounded by cops later and commits suicide. Brent Doonan is shot 5 times. He loses all of his blood over the next 24 hours, all of the blood he started with anyway, and barely survives. And so this is about him. And I would say in Brent's case, this is a similar story. He's got an intense hatred of Barton. He's got an intense hatred of the kind of infamy and notoriety that these killers get. And yet we can't name any of the survivors. I mean, you've got a very learned audience, so let me speak to them for a second.
Sure.
I'll give you Sharon Tate, but name one other name one other victim of a serial killer or a mass murderer.
Sure.
Now, we can name a lot of serial killers and mass murderers, but most of us would have difficulty naming two victims. And I think Brent Doonan carried that kind of resentment, still carries that kind of resentment, even though his life has gotten on a good track and he's doing very well.
Now, I would like to just read part of that letter that you talked about, because it's such a indication of how this guy thought, Barton.
Yeah.
So I'll just read a little bit of it, maybe the last couple paragraphs. But anyway, it says, to whom it may concern. He said, I killed the children to exchange them for 5 minutes of pain for a lifetime of pain. I forced myself to do it to keep them from suffering so much later. No mother, no father, no relatives. The fears of the father are transferred to the son. It was from my father to me and from me to my son. He already had it, and now to be left alone, I had to take him with me. I killed Leanne because she was one of the main reasons for my demise, as I planned to kill the others. I really wish I hadn't killed her now. She really couldn't help it, and I love her so much anyway. I know that Jehovah will take care of all of them in the next life. I'm sure the details don't matter. There is no excuse, no good reason. I'm sure no one would understand. If they could, I wouldn't want them to. Please know that I love Leanne, Matthew, and Michelle with all of my heart. If Jehovah is willing, I would like to see all of them again in the resurrection, to have a second chance. I don't plan to live very much longer, just long enough to kill as many of the people that greedily sought my destruction. You should kill me if you can, Mark O. Barton.
Yeah. I mean, haunting and yeah. Narcissistic. I mean, you know,
sure.
Still blaming everyone else and, you know, convinced of his value. But and it echoes, oddly, the suicide note left by Charles Whitman in the Texas Tower Massacre in Austin in 1966, which is one of the other chapters here,
right.
Where he says, yeah, I'm killing my mother and my wife because I just don't want them to be embarrassed by, you know, what I'm about to do. So, yeah, kind of strange and narcissistic.
Yeah, it's very, you know, it's interesting that all of these people, it seems to have major psychiatric problems, to say the least. But at the same time, there is that, you know, I've never read more stories where that's a mix of, it's almost a textbook psychopathic killer as well, but with these other psychiatric elements. It's for me, not knowing any of these characters, it's fascinating. The killers are fascinating, but you've included the victim stories. A lot of authors, Ann Rule is especially noted for including a lot of the victim stories. But in this particular case, you do really have, really good, fine examples of people that have. There's never closure and there's never full recovery, obviously, but some very, very strong characters and strong examples of survival instinct with these people, especially given the magnitude.
Yeah, and like I said, if they can come out on the other side of those crimes and regain their equilibrium and find their way back to some place that kind of looks normal, then those of us who've had divorces or losses of loved ones or loss of a job, any number of lesser disappointments, then I think there's hope for us. And I that's what I'm hoping, is that these people stand as an example of what's possible. They are not perfect people. They haven't, in most cases, have not returned. They're not whole again.
Sure.
But I'm not sure. I think it would be a myth if you introduced me to somebody who went through what these people had gone through and said, but it has absolutely no impact on his life anymore, and he doesn't even think about it, and he's perfect, he's better than he started, then I would disbelieve that.
Oh, of course, of course. What was interesting, I thought, too, is that Brent Doonan spent a year trying to write a book, and did actually get the book,
he did write a book,
published in 2006. So, again, some more closure, if you know, for lack of a better word. Anyway, at least people being able to mount such a, you know, endeavor to be able to write about their ordeal and get that somewhat out of the way, at least a little bit off their chest. So,
yeah, and that's happened in a couple of the cases. Charles Cohen always wanted to write a book, but it never did. He felt he didn't feel personally that he could, and he was hoping somebody would come along and do it. But Brent Doonan did write a book. Susanna Gracia Hupp from the Luby's Cafeteria Killing wrote a book. Terry Fassbender, or Terry Dupereau, who was in the Bluebell mass murder, the family mass murder in the Caribbean or in the Bahamas. She wrote a book that came out, I guess it was last year. And I think there is a therapeutic value to that.
Sure.
You know, in all of these cases, I think they had to spend a little bit of time trying to see things through a different prism, and it helped them. So well, and Missy Jenkins, who survived the Heath High School shooting, one of the early school shootings before Columbine. She also wrote a book, and in each of those four cases, I think they did a pretty good job of telling the story more or less fairly to all people involved, and I think that's pretty notable when you've been shot or paralyzed or, you know, traumatized the way they were.
Sure. Now tell us about the survivor in the Texas Tower incident in 1966, as you were speaking before I got us off on a little bit of a tangent. Tell us about the survivor
right.
in that case.
Roland Elke was a young man. He just graduated from it wasn't a seminary, but it was a religious oriented Lutheran school in Wisconsin. He was the son of a Lutheran minister. He kind of thought he wanted to be a minister, or at least was being sort of urged in that direction. But he also wanted to see the world. He had this sense of adventure. It's the mid-1960s, and he thinks there's a big world out there he wants to see. So he joins the Peace Corps. He graduates from college in Wisconsin and joins the Peace Corps. He's assigned by the Peace Corps to teach English in a little Iranian school. In order to be able to do that, he has to go to some training at the University of Texas that lasts, I believe, 6 or 8 weeks. So he travels to Austin, and he's doing the courses when, on August 1st, 1966, Charles Whitman climbs the Texas Tower and begins this 90-minute spree of shooting anybody he can from the tower. Famous, one of our most famous mass murders.
Right.
Roland is with a couple of friends walking down the street when they hear what they think are firecrackers or backfires, but it registers, but it's not a concern. At one point, a friend who's walking, there are three walking abreast down the street. The boy in the middle kind of suddenly stops and looks down at his hand, which has just been struck by a bullet, and it breaks his wrist and nearly severs his hand. And you can imagine what has just happened. You know, they don't know, but very quickly more shots are fired, and a couple of them hit Roland. And they scramble to safety, ultimately get out of the line of fire, never really knowing what's going on. They don't know there's a man in the tower shooting. They know that some shooting is going on, but they don't know really what's happening or why they would be in the middle of it, and they don't see anything. Ultimately, he's taken to the hospital, where he recovers from his wounds, oddly, in a room that overlooks the Texas Tower. And, of course, by this time, he knows what has happened. It's during that week, recovering from his wounds, that Roland decides that maybe he does want to become a minister after all, and not because he's afraid, not because Whitman has changed his view of the world or anything like that, other than he sees that he wants that he has a value, that he wants to help people like himself, And he returns to Wisconsin, where he becomes a minister, a Lutheran minister, and also now a college professor in a different religious school. So in that case, we have, you know, this encounter with a killer changes the course of his life and gives him purpose. We don't necessarily see that in all of those cases where they're just kind of scrambling to get back to some sense of normalcy. In his case, it seemed to inoculate him with a sense of purpose, which was interesting to me.
Absolutely. Now, if we could, because I'd like to get a few of these stories, just sort of the outline of these, it's amazing. We can't go through all of them. We don't have enough time. But I was especially stricken by the evil on the front porch, Diane Alexander and the serial killer Derek Todd Lee. Again, a little more well-known case, but still not so well-known to a lot of people either. Tell us about Diane Alexander and the serial killer Derek Todd Lee.
Diane was a nursing student, a black woman in one of the outlying towns around Baton Rouge. This particular summer, a serial killer had sort of risen to the surface in the Baton Rouge area, and he'd largely, well, actually exclusively been attacking white women. A task force that was set up to catch him presumed he was a white killer, a white serial killer, because for a lot of reasons. One is there's so few non-white serial killers, and because serial killers tend to attack victims within their own race. So they made the presumption that it was a white serial killer, and they're off looking in their... In that world. Diane, who's black but very fair-skinned, looks white, actually, from a block away, is home from classes preparing lunch for her son when a black man appears on her porch and knocks on the door. She answers the door, and he has a story. He's looking for someone who lives in the neighborhood, and he's lost, and she doesn't know who he's talking about. And he says, well, can I come in and make a phone call? And she's reluctant to do that. But before she makes a decision one way or another, he storms in, and he attempts to rape and kill her. Her son coming home early, something that he hadn't counted on, startles him, and he runs away. Ultimately, DNA that he leaves behind is what links him to her, but it also links him, after quite a while, to the serial killings that have been happening. So now the whole situation has been upended, and the cops now know who they're looking for. They just don't know where he is. Derek Todd Lee ends up, you know, in the sort of B list of American serial killers. He's frightening, and a lot of legends grow up about him. He never did it, but it was one of the myths going around was that he lured these women out of their homes by playing the recording of a crying baby at their front door. That didn't happen, but it showed how frightened and how desperate for information the citizens were there. Diane becomes a star witness in the trial against Derek Todd Lee. He's convicted of one of the killings, I think, and sentenced to die. And he's on death row now in Louisiana, waiting. I made a request to do an interview with him, as I did with other surviving killers, and in all of these cases with their families. And it's been a few years since I did this, but I think that while I did talk to several of them, none of them really wanted to be interviewed, which is a whole other interesting thing. You know, families of these killers are their victims too. They go through some of the same traumas, and yet they have two added problems. One is that they suffer this sort of stigma, you know, that
sure.
as if they had something to do with it, a kind of a social stigma. The other one is that they're torn between defending their relative and condemning, you know, so they're doing what family does do and trying to be on the side of the relative, but at the same time it's very difficult for them to say, well, you know, this man who annihilates 23 people is just misunderstood. So they struggle with that, which is kind of interesting. And that's, you know, that's a kind of a sidebar. But I did try to do an interview with Derek Todley, and he's never spoken to anyone mm-hmm. on this case. He's never spoken even, I think, to his defense about whether he did or he didn't, but he was, as I say, largely convicted by DNA, so I guess that spoke volumes.
Do you think that some of the killers, was there any reason for some of these killers to not agree to be interviewed based on your perspective for this book, or did they have any indication the unique perspective that you were going to include in the book, or was there any? I could see the families not wanting to continue with this because there's
right.
no real good upside for them having another story about their
exactly.
Family
right.
member
yeah.
that was accused. So, but was that part of the reason why some of these killers wouldn't agree to be interviewed?
I'm sure it was. Now there aren't that many. There was at that time Howard Unruh was still alive.
Right.
But shielded from me by what we call what is called in the United States the HIPAA rules, which are privacy rules that protect patients' information. In his case, the state of New Jersey used those rules to shield him from any contact. In fact, when I asked about doing an interview, their response was, "We can't even tell you if somebody by that name is in our care."
Sure.
So
sure.
That's a non-starter. Derek Todley remains still alive, but again, no response on the interview request. And Michael Carneal, who was the Heath High School shooter, I also asked for an interview with him, and again was just it wasn't denied. It just wasn't. I didn't get any response. So, as I say, in most of these cases, in most mass murder cases, the killer doesn't survive anyway. So it's kind of rare. And in a very macabre sort of way, it's a gift that Jared Lochner survived in Tucson. If we ever hope to really understand these people, we've got to be able to talk to people like him.
Sure, certainly. Yeah, and the thing is too that you might not have been able to speak to these killers, but there was a wealth of information, as there is about the killers, and not so much
yes.
obviously about the victims. So you really got the information that is this unique perspective. You still get these incredible stories because everyone, as you pointed out in your book, really we know of the killers' names because the killers captivate our imagination. Even though there are people that have empathy for victims, it seems in all fictional accounts and even in true accounts that we really know who the killers are. We're a little more fascinated about the killers and their murderous ways rather than the victim and what happens to them after and their welfare. So
right, and they're the actors. They're the gas in the engine. They're the ones making things happen. These victims, whether they survive or not, are being acted upon generally. And in these, in Delivered from Evil, I'm looking at what happens now after, when those victims and survivors now have to become the actors. They have to take charge and make something happen in their lives, or they will simply just stop and die where they stand. So that it's that transition for them from being the target to being the catalyst for a change in their life.
And certainly with this book, you have given these victims a voice like I have not read in most books. It's again, you do hear about the victim, but not in the context of such a tale of survival. So you've given a voice to some really strong characters that happen to be very, very strong and resilient survivors of these incredible crimes. And you've definitely given a voice to these people and in the process offered a unique perspective for the true crime fan. It's always looking for something a little bit different, and this book provides that. So congratulations to you on this book.
Thank you very much.
Thank you much. So, yes, I want to thank you very much, Ron, for a fascinating interview about an incredible book, Delivered from Evil. And I want to know, what's your next project, or what's on the agenda for you? I know you're a busy, prolific author. So.
You know, it looks prolific. I'm not sure how prolific I am. But, you know, I'm considering a project in which I, you know, explore the passions of a few cold case detectives who just have latched, not cold case detectives, of investigators, of police type, of historical, of journalistic type, who have latched on to one particular case and can't let go. Some of them into their retirements. Certainly many of them for decades. I'm fascinated by that kind of passion. But I'm also looking at maybe taking a little bit of a break from the true crime and letting my subconscious refill a little bit and doing a few other projects that will please me. I have a book coming out in the fall called The Sour Toe Cocktail Club, which largely takes place there in Canada.
Wow.
It's a road trip memoir about this extraordinary journey I took with my teenage son to Dawson in the Yukon Territory, and then after that to the Arctic beyond, where, you know, it's about a father and son trip, but we went up there basically to test ourselves against the famous sour toe cocktail, which is a drink into which they drop a mummified human toe.
Wow.
You Canadians know how to live.
Well, I don't even know anything about it, so I best find out about that anyway. So that sounds fascinating, though, Ron, so thank you very much for that. Yes, I just want to tell people they've been listening to Ron Francel, Deliver from Evil, True Stories of Ordinary People Who Faced Monstrous Mass Killers and Survived. Deliver from Evil. Thank you very much, Ron, for a very great interview and appearing on my little program. Thank you very much,
well,
and have a great evening.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
Thank you, Ron. Have a good evening. Good night.
Good night now.
You're listening to the program True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Good night.